Hi, Anne.
Hi.
How are you? This is Jeannie Hyatt.
Oh, fine, thanks. How are you, Jeannie?
I am fine. Glad to have you. And there's someone else on the call. Hello? Maybe not.
Hi. Hi, Linda Broderick.
Oh, hi. We're glad
hi,
to have you.
Hi, how are you?
Hello.
Hi there. Who's that? Oh, hi,
Sam
Howard.
Welsh over at Lighting Environment.
Yep. Hello.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning, Howard.
Hey, Jean. How's everybody?
Great.
Fine.
Good. Everybody like this nice sunny weather?
I'll take it.
Very nice after such a cold winter.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi. How you doing?
Fine, thank you.
We got about 5 minutes, folks, till game time.
Good morning, it's Ann Barnes.
Hi, Ann.
Hello.
Hi, Ann.
How you doing?
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Who is that?
About 3 or 4 minutes, folks.
Okay.
Good morning.
Hello.
Hello.
Another minute or so, guys, so get ready.
All right.
Okay.
Not that you have to do anything.
I have pens ready.
Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Hey.
Is that Mike?
Yeah, hi, Hal.
Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Good,
hi,
you, my friend?
Good.
Hey, good morning, this is Lita Hill from Saville.
Hi, Lita, how are you?
Good, how are you doing?
Hi, Lita.
Hello,
this is Elton. This is Elton.
Hi, Elton. This is Jeannie. Nice to hear from you.
Yeah, I've been out the loop for a little bit. I've just got off vacation. I went to Tucson, Arizona.
Oh, nice. My God.
It's nice down there, guys. It's a really nice city. Got to go if you haven't been.
That's life.
Nice.
Okay. It is 9:02 on my famous official clock, and I'm going to get started. Welcome to everybody. Howard Thurman. The next telebrief, obviously, is the fourth Wednesday in June, which by my calendar is June the 25th. Hard to believe, but it is. And so there's a fair amount to report this morning. The biggest news, actually, that I saw was on the Internet this morning, where Dunkin' Donuts is expanding into California. Those of you who have Dunkin' Donuts on your desk like I do right now, that's big news. So anything that I'll tell you will pale in comparison to that. Okay. Let's get started. And there's a bunch of statutory news, actually, to report, one of which happens in our backyard here in Baltimore. Those of you who have employees who work in the city of Baltimore probably know that on May the 15th, the mayor of Baltimore, Stephanie Rawlings Blake, signed legislation which is called Ban the Box legislation. And it essentially means that any employer who has 10 or more employees in the city of Baltimore cannot, I repeat, cannot check into an applicant's criminal background history until and unless a conditional offer of employment has been made to that particular applicant. Those of you who have read this statute, and I've read it several times, will note that it's extremely poorly written, which is no surprise to me, although Stephanie Rawlings Blake is a graduate of the University of Maryland Law School, my alma mater, and I'm disappointed that she didn't pick up several things that are really poorly drafted in the statute. The Baltimore Ban the Box legislation theoretically is modeled after similar legislation in many other municipalities. This actually goes beyond many of the ones that have been passed, and I'll get to that in a couple minutes. But I wanted to talk about a few of the salient points in this particular legislation for your benefit if you have employees that work in Baltimore City. So first, in the statute, covered employer is defined as any person that employs 10 or more full-time equivalent employees in the city of Baltimore. Now, that means that, for instance, if you are an employer that may be based in Anne Arundel County or Prince George's County or Montgomery County, but you happen to have 10 or more employees that work in Baltimore City, you would be covered by this particular statute. The interesting thing is that from a jurisdictional standpoint and even a constitutional standpoint, I don't believe, excuse me, that if you had an employer that's based in Baltimore City but only had employees who were working in Baltimore County or outside of the city, the question would be, can the Baltimore City Council regulate conduct of an employer that doesn't have employees in Baltimore City? So I don't believe, frankly, that it's a very well-drafted piece of legislation, but it is what it is, and it goes into effect August the 15th, or thereabouts, 90 days after the mayor has signed the particular piece of legislation. So between now and August, and I'll get to this in a minute, you need to be taking some remedial measures if you have 10 or more employees in Baltimore City. Now, the statute goes on to expressly say that it may not be construed to require any employer to hire someone with a criminal record, nor to limit an employer's ability to choose the most qualified and appropriate applicant for the employment opportunity at hand. Which means, from a practical standpoint, if in fact you do not conduct a criminal background check until after a conditional offer has been made, then you are free to reject an applicant if that applicant has a criminal background. All of the statute really is doing is saying that prior to a conditional offer of employment being made, you cannot go ahead and do a criminal background check on the individual. So from a practical standpoint, obviously what you want to do as an employer who's covered in Baltimore City is make sure that you do not have a question regarding criminal background on your application form. That means that some of you may need to have two application forms, one for those employees or applicants who are applying for a job in Baltimore City, and one for the rest of your applicants who are not applying for a job in Baltimore City. Now remember, this statute has express exclusions to it. One exclusion is for any employer that is subjected to any federal, state, or local statute that would require a criminal background check to be done on an applicant. So there are many of you who may in fact be subjected to a statute, whether it's local, federal, or state, that will require you to do criminal background checks, and therefore this statute would not apply to you. It also does not apply to any facility or employer that provides programs, services, or direct care to minors or to vulnerable adults. Some of you may, in fact, work for companies or agencies or nonprofits that are in that particular sphere. The very scary thing about this statute is the enforceability of it. First, in terms of what an employee can file a charge with the Baltimore City Human Relations Commission, and ultimately that employee can get back pay for lost wages, can be reinstated, or can get compensatory damages as well as attorney's fees. The sort of draconian part about this statute is that it says any person who violates any provisions of this subtitle is guilty of a misdemeanor, and on conviction is subject to a fine of not more than $500 or imprisonment for not more than 90 days or both. So this statute, unlike many of the ban-the-box legislative actions and enactments in many municipalities, there is a criminal sanction which is associated with the statute, which I find to be really crazy from a legislative legislative history purpose, that there are many, many statutes that don't go near having a criminal sanction attached to it. So I believe, first of all, there are no regulations which have been promulgated to enforce this particular statute. I believe it'll be the subject of a great number of legislative challenges and judicial challenges by companies that have the wherewithal to do that, because, again, it is poorly written. But just a few practical things. As I said, make sure that if you have people that are applying for a job in Baltimore City, that your application does not have a question regarding criminal background. Secondly, make sure that you train your interviewers to not ask questions about criminal backgrounds of those applicants until and unless their conditional offer of employment has been made. And when you do have a conditional offer of employment, put it in writing and make sure that the applicant knows that employment is conditioned expressly upon a successful passing of a criminal background check. So that act, again, will go into effect on or about August the 15th of this year. Maryland legislature also passed a statute which is entitled the Fairness for All Marylanders Act, which essentially creates another protected classification against transgendered individuals in employment, housing, credit, and public accommodation. So gender identity will now be a protected classification under Maryland law, in addition to those historical protected classifications that we all know about. And this legislation will go into effect October 1st of this year. October 1st, some months from now, that'll be in effect. So any individual who's classified as transgendered will be protected under the new statute. I want to turn my attention to another piece of legislation that has, I think, a great deal of significance, and that is a statute that was at least enacted and ready for the governor's signature in Puerto Rico, and it's the first United States jurisdiction to essentially address workplace bullying. And on June the 3rd, just, you know, a couple weeks ago, the Puerto Rico Senate and House approved a final version of its Senate Bill 501. It's a law entitled, in quotes, Law to Prohibit and Prevent Workplace Harassment in Puerto Rico. And the stated purpose of this particular piece of legislation is to prohibit workplace bullying, which would not be typically protected under your typical anti-discrimination laws. Those of you who have participated in these telebriefs know that I have for some time predicted that there will be a groundswell of legislation in many jurisdictions which will now establish as a statutorily prohibited activity workplace bullying, even if it would not typically fall in the category of protected activity or prohibited activity, I should say, under typical anti-discrimination statutes. So that in the Puerto Rican statute, it is workplace harassment is defined as follows, and I'll read it to you. It is ill-intended, unwelcome, repetitive conduct. Notice the use of the words repetitive conduct, whether it be verbal, written, or physical, on behalf of the employer, its supervisors or employees, distinct from the legitimate business interest of the company, that creates a hostile, intimidating, humiliating, and offensive atmosphere, impedes the healthy tenure of the employee in the workplace, that can bring scorn, belittle, or professionally destroy the employee, and that threatens his or her constitutionally protected rights, including his or her dignity. You can see it's a very wide-ranging and broad-based definition of workplace harassment, and it is not surprising that it uses the words repetitive conduct, because as you've heard me talk about both in terms of in seminars and in prior telebriefs, it is not the singular word or the singular act that would come within the ambit of workplace bullying. Rather, it is the pattern, it is the practice, the repetitive conduct of an employer or even a co-employee that brings it within the ambit of prohibited workplace bullying. The statute, as it's drafted, includes a series of actions which are considered to be workplace harassment, which I find to be illuminating. So, the following acts are considered to be within the jurisdiction or within the definition of workplace bullying: slanderous and harmful expressions about a person using foul language, hostile and humiliating comments of professional incompetence in the presence of coworkers, unjustified threats of termination stated in the presence of coworkers, frivolous disciplinary actions, humiliating rejection of work proposals or opinions, public comments or jokes directed to the employee about physical appearance or the manner of dress, public reference to private, personal, or family matters related to the affected employee, assigning work functions clearly unrelated to employment obligations, and a refusal to provide information or materials pertinent and indispensable to fulfill the employment obligations. In this particular statute, if it is signed by the governor, it would create a statutory obligation on the part of an employer to actually adopt and implement internal policies and procedures in order to prevent workplace harassment, to investigate charges or complaints, and to impose appropriate penalties under if certain investigations prove that the prohibited actions have taken place. It also makes the employer liable for acts of workplace harassment which are conducted on its employees by non-employees, for instance, by vendors. It also says that there would be an exhaustion of remedies provision, which would mean that an employee would have to partake of internal mechanisms, for instance, a grievance procedure, prior to seeking external remedies through the governmental agencies that would enforce these. If it's ultimately proven that the employee was the victim of workplace harassment, that employee would be able to achieve or get reinstatement, back pay, and injunctive relief. I bring this to your attention because, to me, as I've said many, many times before, I really believe that we are on the cusp of probably a major movement in this country from a legislative standpoint on many jurisdictions that will promulgate statutes prohibiting workplace bullying. And frankly, it is not necessarily a bad thing. And to be proactive and to be on the right side of this trend, you ought to be taking a look, as I've said many times before, at your workplace harassment policies in your handbooks and make sure that you amend them. Now is the appropriate time to amend them to include anti-bullying and anti-workplace harassment policies. It will also, by almost definition, require you to train not only your supervisors but your employees, your rank-and-file employees, on the issue of workplace bullying. And I will say that in addition to Puerto Rico, Tennessee has just passed legislation on prohibiting workplace bullying involving public sector employers. And the statute is called the Healthy Workplace Campaign, and it was promulgated and passed on June the 3rd and signed by Tennessee Governor Bill Haslam. And it gives public sector employers an incentive to adopt a model to prohibit workplace bullying. So all the tea leaves are basically indicating that this is something that needs to be paid attention to. It's not going to go away. The amount of attention which is being paid to it through social media and through various other media, whether it be television, radio, the internet, is one of these things that will be a constant source of attention, and therefore I am really telling you that to be responsible, you ought to be taking a look at your policies and being in front of modifying those policies. It is not a costly thing to do. It's not as though it involves a great deal of modification. And if you need some help on changing the wording of your policies or how to go about creating that kind of policy, certainly I can help you with that if you need some help. But it is not a big to-do. I not only think it's the legally correct thing to do, I think it's the morally correct thing to do, that there should be no employee in your workplace who is subjected on a repetitive basis to the kinds of bullying and harassing kinds of conduct, even if it doesn't fall technically within the ambit of the anti-discrimination statutes, either on a federal or state level. Now's the time to take a look at it, because there will be many, many more enactments, I'm sure, on a local state level and perhaps down the road on the federal level as well. Let me turn my attention to a topic I know I've spoken about many times, which is restrictive covenants, that is, restrictions on post-employment conduct. Many of you may have restrictive covenants for certain level employees. And I wanted to bring to your attention a case that was decided by a federal court in Arkansas. Not that that may be applicable to many of you, but I think it's instructive. And this case involved an employer called West Memphis Steel and Pipe. And in its restrictive covenants, it restricted two employees from soliciting the company's, in quotes, past, present, or prospective future customers or clients. Now, two of these employees brought a lawsuit in federal court, and the lawsuit was in the nature of what's called a declaratory judgment action. A declaratory judgment action is a lawsuit where the plaintiff asked the court to declare that the terms of a written agreement or a written document means a certain thing. So in other words, where there may be a dispute as to the enforceability of a particular agreement, one of the parties to that agreement may in fact file what's called a declaratory judgment action and ask the court to say, under these terms and conditions which are set forth in the agreement, what really does it mean or what does it signify? And that's what these two employees brought. And in their lawsuit, they were basically saying or asking the court to determine that the restriction or the purported restriction on having them not be able to approach so-called prospective future customers was overly broad, and that therefore the entire restrictive covenant should be thrown out. In fact, what the court said in Arkansas was that the following, I'll quote it. They said, how close a non-compete clause comes to being enforceable to being just broad enough does not matter. If it misses by an inch, it misses by a mile. And so the Arkansas court threw the entire clause out. Now, the reason I bring this to your attention is, again, and I've said this before, you need to go back if you're utilizing restrictive covenants, not necessarily covenants on restricting the disclosure of confidential information. You don't have too much to worry about that. But if you're seeking to prevent a departing employee from competing with your company, whether that person is an executive or a middle-level manager or a salesperson, which often is the case, make sure that you are not too greedy and that you don't try and be overly broad with regard to your restriction, because many courts in many states where you may be doing business will say if it is overbroad, and in this case it was deemed to be overbroad because it was seeking to prevent the departing employee from competing with the prior employer over so-called prospective customers. That is, customers that the company really didn't even have when the employee departed. So how would the employee know who those prospective customers were? And therefore, the court said it's overly broad and they're not going to modify the non-compete. They will just invalidate or void the entire non-compete. So I would urge you, if you are utilizing non-compete agreements and seeking to prevent departing employees from competing with your company, make sure that it is really custom drafted to be as narrow as possible with regard to the competitive interest that you are seeking to prevent competition with. The last thing that I want to talk about is an interesting wage and hour case, which is in the pipeline now, against Apple. Apple, of course, has millions and millions of dollars to spend on litigation, but they are currently facing a wage and hour claim on employees who are claiming that the time spent waiting in security check lines in the Apple stores, in other words, either at the end or before a break or before they leave for the day, the time that they spend in those security check lines should be considered to be work time. Apple has not been paying that. There is a case that will be pending in the Supreme Court called Integrity Staffing Solutions versus Busk. And it was filed March 7th, 2014, in which this issue may be decided. And so what these employees are claiming is that the time spent in required off-the-clock security checks should be considered to be time worked. Now, you may say, well, that can't be a large amount of time, but the fact of the matter is it amounts to about 50 to 90 minutes a week, and for the number of employees involved, could potentially cost Apple millions and millions of dollars. So I bring it up for two reasons. One, as I've told you before, the Department of Labor is hot to trot on many companies who have employees who are so-called working off the clock. You need to pay attention to whether or not you're in situations where employees are not being paid for so-called off-the-clock work, that is, before work or after work, or during breaks, etc. Secondly, this is a sort of a unique situation, and I don't know how many of you out there utilize security checks within your company, but if you do, you're going to need to pay attention to this case, as I will, because one of the issues will be whether or not you really need to pay for employees who are going through these security checks if you consider them to be off the clock. So it's an important case. Again, it involves a prominent employer, an employer certainly that has deep pockets and can spend a lot of money on litigating this. So I suspect that it will be litigated and that it will make news down the road. As always, I'm happy to answer any questions any of you may have, either privately or by getting in touch with me personally. My email is hkerman, H-K-U-R-M-A-N, at offitkerman.com. My direct phone number is 410-209-6417. Hopefully there was a lot of practical information that you guys got this morning on many of these developments. Any questions or comments from the Peanut Gallery?
Oh, I got one. I want to tell you, first of all, this is Lita Hill. Thank you, Harry.
Hey, Lita.
Especially the information about Baltimore City.
Yes.
I did not realize, because we had just updated the application to just broadly ask about criminal. And so now I see we need to remove it. Is that a remove it as soon as possible or remove it by August?
Well, I would say remove it by August. You're not going to get in trouble, frankly, between now and August. But I think that when August the 15th comes, it better be off your application form.
Yeah, but we have an office in Elkridge, and it sounds like we don't have to do that change for Elkridge, but we definitely have to do it for Baltimore City.
You do have to do it for Baltimore City. Now, another way of doing it would be to have, if you want to, have an attachment to your application form which indicates that that particular question need not and should not be answered by anybody applying for a job in Baltimore City. It's one way to do it. My preference would be that you simply remove it from your application form because I think it offers more legal protection. But if you don't want to do it that way, certainly have an accompanying statement that says that applicants who are applying for jobs in Baltimore City need not and should not complete that particular question.
Okay, that's great.
Okay, any other questions?
Thank you.
No.
Okay, well, as always, I appreciate your participation, and we will see you, hopefully, or see you figuratively, in 2 weeks.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.